people consider Erasmus as the father, the spiritual father of the Reformation, but we really certainly don't need to discuss that. But the Christian Bible scholars of the early 1500s, late 1400s, early 1500s, when they were starting to discover the concept of intellectual honesty, etc., they were almost without an exception, were absolute anti-Semites, absolute anti-Chazal, refused to take Chazal with any amount of seriousness at all.
This is the birth.
But they were still very, very devout Catholics or Christians, and they did not give Chazal any significant weight and did not take their opinion seriously at all. That is, Ruchlin, who you may have heard of, you may not have heard of, it's not so important. Ruchlin was not that anti-Chazal, so he's like sort of an exception. But it's nothing compared to the Philo-Semites in the mid-1600s, early 1700s, the mid-late 1600s, early 1700s, where you have non-Jewish scholars studying Chazal, Midrashim, etc., etc., in a very serious fashion. They're Christian Kabbalists, etc., etc., studying Chazal in a very, very serious way. I mean, it'd be fascinating to see some of the things they've said. I've never.
What does a Christian Kabbalist mean? What does that mean?
That you're asking good and hard questions. Of course, one of them was Isaac Newton, as you may be aware of. But all of these things together are making, instead are like changing an atmosphere of attitude in, the higher circles towards Jews. All these things in Europe are changing attitude towards Jews, that as opposed to being anti-Jewish, they are not as anti-Jewish, sometimes pro-Jewish. You do have a couple of rare exceptions. I didn't want to get bogged down in the Philo-Semites, but because it's fascinating. The book I have here is not the right book. There's a different book that's much better about them. Did a much better job about them. I'm very unclear how much direct impact all the Philo-Semites had on history. That's an interesting question, which would take a lot of work, which I don't feel like doing. Okay. Chips. Okay, what is important for us is the general attitude towards Jews is definitely very much changed from Jews and towards Chazal, is instead of looking at Jews as, the devil incarnate, which the masses still did. Many of the masses still did, but the intellectuals in Europe were looking at Jews with a more positive light, not as negative light. That there's no question about, and that opens up the way for the era of the court Jew. Okay, now it's sort of like this. Even England at this time is really a monarchy. It's a constitutional monarchy. I mean, the Glorious Revolution, which we should get to, I hope, tonight. It's still a constitutional monarchy. You understand that the King of England had at least as much power as the President as late as George III. Even George IV probably had that amount of power. The reason why William IV, or III, or whoever's after George, didn't is because he was not that great of a leader figure. It's an interesting question what Victoria could or couldn't have done, but she on principle believed in constitutional monarchy and only exercising her opinion in extreme cases. So that's like spinning. But you understand, up until 1830, the English king had a very significant amount of power. A very significant amount of power. No less than the president does today, and certainly even William and Mary. What?
Commander in chief.
Say again.
Commander in chief.
Just more than that. There wasn't. Even though it's proto-democracy, it wasn't the exact same. It's not. It wasn't. It wasn't the ballot in England was until 1832 was quite limited. So it's not really. It's not really. What's the right words? It's not. It's not really such, it's not as democratic as we like they portray it, or you'll see it portrayed in many places. Anyway, what's the point? The point is when you have one man rule, when you have one man rule, when a monarch's really ruling something, he needs a way to get something done. And bureaucratic methodology had not yet been invented. The people who invented bureaucratic methodology are the Prussians. Was the Elector of Brandenburg, Frederick William, Elector of Brandenburg, is one of the people who invented.
Frederick the Great.
Frederick the Great's afterwards. Frederick the Great. Frederick the Great is. Let's see if we can get this right. Frederick the Great is around 1750, 53, 54. That feels about right. 1754 until 1786 to 90.
So when was Frederick?
Frederick William the Great Elector is from 1640 to 1688.
Also known as Frederick the Bureaucrat.
No. Well, he's known. His accomplishment was he invented bureaucracy, but it took a lot of time. It took a long time. Administrative bureaucracy was invented by Frederick William, the Great Elector. Creating. That's right. Creating administration that the executive branch could efficiently, in a fair way, you know, get to a state. That's what he wanted to create. Now, no one had the same level of bureaucracy as Frederick as they did in Prussia for a long time. But Prussia really, you know, without diverging too much, Prussia really should have been a medium-sized state, not playing that much part on the great European, you know, plateau of things, but it did much more than that simply because he was able to harness the power he had much more efficiently than anyone else. Now, England and Holland, of course, are a little different because they're trading nations and there's a lot of trading wealth going through them.
Which is ephemeral.
What?
Sort of ephemeral in a way.
So who?
Ephemeral.
Ephemeral. Okay, it sort of was in a sense. Not in England, it lasted for a long time. In England, it lasted for a long time. So how did the rest of Central Europe cope with Frederick William inventing bureaucracy?
They tried to copy it.
They tried a little bit. They could have coped by using court shoes. They brought the Jews in. That's right. That's how they come. Now, Frederick William did also, for the records, he also had his court Jews. But the rest of Europe, and especially the Austrian Habsburgs, had no choice. The only way they could counter that, even though, you know, if you look at the territories, the Austrian Habsburgs versus Prussia, certainly in the 1600s, it's like a joke to think that Prussia could play any part, because the Austrian Habsburgs had territories multiple sized at times. And not even forgetting about prestige, et cetera, natural alliances. It's like, it's unbelievable. So they brought in what are called the court Jews. Now, the court Jews, in my opinion, are able to play a part, a major part in this era in history, from the late 1600s to the early mid 1700s, simply because bureaucracy was just starting. So you have monarchs who are controlling, you know, state policy. They don't have to care about what anyone says. What they need in order to carry out their state policy is quick cash. That's what you need. How do you get quick cash?
Rothschilds.
Okay. The Rothschilds are later. The Rothschilds are already later, and they're not as do not have as much independence. The way you get quick cash. The way you get quick cash. And that's another thing. Also, that's another thing. That's I wrote that in my notes here. That I think also another one of the reasons why the court Jew came into being was because warfare before this time, gunpowder played a lesser part. Now, after the musket has been better developed, after the musket has been developed more, and the sword and the lance are not as important, then I have something another problem. On one hand, I don't have to train nearly as well. On the other side of the coin, and I also have a very deadly weapon. The other side of the coin is it needs to be constantly supplied. You need constantly supplied means you need people, you need someone who could do all these arrangements for you, and you need cash to get things from here to there, from here to da. And that is where the court Jews come in. They combine. The court Jews were, some of them Sephardi, so Portuguese Jews are the beginning of the court Jew. But the great era of the court Jews, mostly Ashkenazi Jews, they combined the trading network in the Ashkenazi trading network, which went from Western Germany initially all the way through Poland. They combined that together with the Portuguese Jewish trading network, and then we have a court Jew who's able to get supplies all over the place faster than anyone else. There's no military bureaucracy. There's very little national bureaucracy. But war and state conflicts are all over the place. And this is in my opinion why the court Jew arose. And
was it just because the Jews had the network, or the networks, or because they had the skills, or both?
Probably a combination of the two. It was a constant theme, which we'll get to more next week, I believe. I don't think we can get to this week. We'll get to next week. There was constant pressure on the Austrian Habsburgs, who were very religious, devout Catholics. Like, why are you employing so many Jews in such high positions? And the answer inevitably was, so find a non-Jew who could do the same job and we're happy to take him. But you haven't found it, so tough luck. Okay, so what happens? One thing is these Jews were able to gain rights, and rights of, rights to live somewhere. And I think we'll see at least one case of that pretty soon. That Jews, in other words, Jews had been expelled from most of Germany earlier. They had made a certain amount of, gains back into different parts of Germany in the 30 Years' War, which we spoke about already. The court Jews are even able to go beyond that. That's one thing. They also are going to be, court Jews are honored by European nobility repetitively. At a little later point, there are Jews who are given noble titles, and sort of hand in hand with that is that the court Jews, generally speaking, didn't remain Jewish for that long. I mean, that's like sad to say, but those are they remain for a certain amount of time. There are very few court Jews. There's only one court Jew that I know of who has Jewish descendants today. No, the Barbanels aren't really a court Jew. That's before that time. It's not the Barbanel. The Barbanel is not the exact same thing. The Barbanel is the very tail end of Spanish Jewry, and how Spanish Jewry in the golden era, in the different golden eras of Spain, had certain similarities, but it wasn't. It's not the exact same thing. It's not the same thing because it's hard to know what percentage of Spain was Jewish. But Muslim Spain approximately was like this. The Muslims came and conquered Spain. Okay, the Muslims did not engage in trade. Almost Peshitta. So all the trade, all the what?
The Berbers.
Trade. All the trade in Spain was in Jewish hands, practically, in Muslim Spain. Trade, etc., etc. The Jews, yes, but Muslims, it's not the same thing, because Muslims, as long as they're ruling, they don't feel religiously threatened by Jews. So it was not, Jews played a medium to large part in different Muslim countries historically through the ages. It's not like, wow, what's going on? Fuck it. After Muslim political power declined, then Muslims are more anti-Semitic. When Muslim political power is strong, Muslims are more philo-Semitic.
But that doesn't exist today.
That's true, because Muslim political power has declined. The Muslim world perceives itself at the lower end politically against the Western world. And they are. I'm not sure if I'm remembering this one right, but I believe, I saw this 10, 12 years ago, that there's like five times the amount, maybe it's three times the amount of books translated into Hebrew as there are into Arabic. And that's totally ridiculous. You understand this? The only people who read Hebrew are Jews and Israeli Jews who didn't live in America for a long time. You know what I mean? That's it. So what, there's 6 million Jews who need something translated into Hebrew?
That's three times.
I don't forget the number, but yeah, it was like shocking. Like, there are more, there's not a little more, there's a significant amount more, as I recall, a number of times more books translated into Hebrew than into Arabic. And there are hundreds of millions of people who speak Arabic. not Keila. Not Keila. Yeah, okay. Okay, so these court Jews, one of the other things as we say is, these court Jews...
But Romans, literacy rates are lower, though.
And Arabs are relatively literate. They're not... Arabs are generally speaking...
They're much less educated than...
Right, that's true. That's true. That's all true.
Level, but, I mean, in terms of
okay. Okay, whatever. Vaitre. Okay, so, as said before, but this is really the right place to say it, these court Jews are going to play a part in the early Haskalah and core of not-so-religiously committed Jews in the Ashkenazi world. That's what they're going to play a part in. Okay, now let's just see, let's at least hit the first court Jew, and we're going to start out with the Pereiras, who I'm sure you haven't heard of.
Pereira.
Pereira. I think I'm pronouncing it right. Here, hopefully I won't cut off another
one. There's many ways to spell Pereira depending on what region or religion.
That sounds right. I mean, I think it should be pronounced Pereira, shouldn't it?
Is it Spanish?
Portuguese. Portuguese. Pereira. Pereira. Okay, we have the Pereiras. The Pereiras were a Portuguese Jewish family. Father's name is Abraham. He has two sons, Jacob and David. And they were very, very... They were the court Jews of someone who's called William III. William III of Holland.
Please.
Who ended up becoming...
William of Orange.
No, William of Orange is great, 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 great. William of Orange started the Dutch Revolution in the 1530s. That we are now in the 1670s. William III became stadtholder of Holland.
State.
Well, yeah, stadtholder. It's not mamish king, but it's close enough as it could be said.
In what year?
1672.
1672. So that's the same time that.
Okay, he became stadtholder. He became stadtholder, and as we already saw, as we saw last week with Spinoza, Holland was uniquely tolerant, and he in the Pereiras.
Tied to the thriving trade relations, yeah.
Say again?
The Dutch being more tolerant.
Well, the Dutch, see, it's part of like sort of like this. Is the Dutch worked on the theory of my enemy's enemy is my friend. So as the Spanish were anti-Jewish, the Spanish were anti-Jewish, so therefore the Dutch are pro-Jewish. Okay, he used the Pereiras to help him fight the French. Louis XIV's wife was a Spanish princess. And they were supposed to give him a dowry.
Wait,
Louis XIV's wife. Louis XIV, the Sun King. The famous Louis XIV, the man who built Versailles.
Louis XVI
is the guy who died. The guy was beheaded. That's right. Louis XIV built the very famous palace called Versailles. Right? His wife was Spanish. He was supposed to get a dowry of I forget what. Not so important. I could have looked it up. It wasn't so important. He did not get that dowry. He therefore said, because you didn't give me my dowry, I will take the Low Countries as my dowry. Because you are the legal, she is the legal heiress of the Low Countries.
No, sorry.
So he went and invaded the Holland. Which in other words, he's not recognizing all Dutch independence, etc., etc., etc. He's saying this is my legal rights because my wife didn't. The Spanish were supposed to give me this. This started 1672. This started the great set of wars of 40 years. A 40 year set of wars. They were fighting more than they weren't between the Dutch against the French.
We'll get there.
Okay. So William is really, it was in a tough place, as it could be said. He was a tremendous diplomat. He managed, initially he convinces the Austrians, later the Spanish, and later he takes England. And instrumental in all of this was his financial cooperation with the Pereiras, who are like the prototype of the court Jews. He used the Pereiras and what's the other guy's name? Mercado, to move supplies all over the place. And one of the things they did, they were fighting throughout northern Germany. They were fighting throughout northern Germany. I mean, technically speaking, the French had a better army, better state apparatus, etc., etc. The Dutch were only able to counter this because they had the Pereiras and the Mercados and the other Portuguese. Yeah. And they, one of the things they did, this is historical, they forced the Dutch and the Austrians would force cities to allow the agents, the Jewish agents of these people, to go into these cities. In other words, they had to, an army in the old times needed horses, horse food, which is called fodder, and if you're not aware of that, and gunpowder. And in order, if you're fighting a major war, you need it all over the place, and you need supplies all over the place. And the Pereiras and Mercados were the suppliers of the Dutch armies. And they would force different cities in Germany, which legally would not allow Jews to be there, to allow Jews there in order that they would be able to efficiently fight it. Of course, one of the other Jews. Well, the Louis XIV was not that, he was in the middle. Okay. Of course, one of the other very famous events that the Pereiras were involved in, I was not able, for the sources I had, I was not able to see if they were absolutely necessary or just happened to be involved in because they were already very friendly with him, was the Glorious Revolution, when William wants to invade England. William, actually, in case you're not aware of this, it's true his wife, Mary, was James II's daughter. That's all true. But he was also his wife's second cousin or something on those lines, and he had his own legal claim to the English throne. Yes, he did. Yeah. Not that he was next in line, but because his... I didn't have time to look that up, and it was not clear on Wikipedia either, so I can't really say it over right now. But he did have his legal claims to the English throne. So his grandmother approximately was... maybe it was his great-grandmother. He had his claims. He was certainly, there's no question that in fact he used his Jewish suppliers to outfit his army that he invaded England with in 1688. That's 100% true. Whether the only way he could have done it, in other words, I'm not sure if he needed the speed. In other words, the Jewish suppliers, the advantage they had over the non-Jewish ones is they could do it twice as fast. I don't know. It looked to me like that wasn't really necessary. Rather, this is what happened because he actually had these pre-existing connections. And of course, he becomes king of England, and that's really, to a very large extent, the beginning of modern democracy, Glorious Revolution, English Bill of Rights, very, very key events. He brings Jews into England. They were already sort of in England. He brings them even more into England. And I'm not sure if this is the first, but a Portuguese Jew by the name of Salomão de Medina was the first Jew knighted in around 1702 or so. The first Jew knighted, you know, like knighted. The first Jew knighted in England in modern times. And that, we'll call it there right now. Fine. Out of time, guys. We'll see you after Hanukkah.